Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, April 15th, 2025, we're delighted to host a Courthouse Steps decision program on FDA versus Wages and White Lion Investments, LLC, which was decided earlier this month by the court. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, we will keep our introductions of our guests today brief, certainly more brief than their careers would deserve. So I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us as our moderator, Eli Nachmani, who is an associate at Covington & Burling LLP in their Washington, D.C. office. Before coming to Covington & Burling, he clerked for Judge Steve Menasche on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. And prior to law school, Mr. Nachmani served as a speechwriter to the U.S. Secretary of the Interior and as a domestic policy aide in the White House Office of American Innovation. His scholarship on administrative law and executive power has appeared in the BYU Law Review, George Mason Law Review, Wake Forest Law Review, and Yale Law Journal Forum, I'll leave it to him to introduce our panel. A last note before I get off your screens, if you have any questions throughout the program, please do submit those via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so it'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that all questions submitted there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Mr. Nachmani, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Kayla, and thank you to the Federalist Society for inviting me to moderate today. We really do have an all-star panel, and I want to get into that panel as quickly as we possibly can. So I'll begin by introducing our panel. I'll say a little bit about the Supreme Court's decision, and then we'll kick it off for opening remarks. At about the halfway point through our webinar, so figure about 1:30 Eastern time, we'll begin to take question and answer from the audience. You should feel free to put those questions in the chat box, and we'll try to get to as many of them as we can. So let me begin by introducing our really excellent panel. We have Jonathan Adler, who is the inaugural Johann Verhage Memorial Professor of Law and the founding director of the Coleman P. Burke Center for Environmental Law at the Case Western Reserve University School of Law, where he teaches courses in environmental, administrative, and constitutional law. Professor Kristen Hickman is a distinguished McKnight University professor and Harlan Albert Rogers professor in law at the University of Minnesota Law School. She is a leading authority in the fields of tax administration, administrative law, and statutory interpretation. And Richard Pierce is the Lyle T. Alverson professor of law at the George Washington University Law School. He's the author of over 20 books and 130 articles on administrative law, government regulation, and the effects of various forms of government intervention on the performance of markets. I should also note that Professors Hickman and Pierce co-authored the Administrative Law Treatise on Federal Administrative Law, really a wonderful treatise. So the decision that we're talking about today is the subject of our webinar, is FDA against Wages and White Lion Investments, LLC. Now, this is an important administrative law decision. But maybe what's also important is that the Supreme Court decided it unanimously, 9-0. In this case, what the Supreme Court was doing, it was reviewing a decision of the Fifth Circuit. And the Fifth Circuit had held that the Food and Drug Administration acted arbitrarily and capriciously when it had denied authorization to market certain electronic nicotine delivery system products, or what we might know as e-cigarettes or vapes. The court's decision evaluated four different elements of what it described as potential changes in position that the FDA had engaged in during its process of considering authorization. On three of those elements of the possible change of position, the court determined that the FDA had not acted arbitrarily and capriciously. On the fourth element of that, the FDA had asked for the court to vacate and remand back to the Fifth Circuit because the Fifth Circuit had a little bit of difficulty reconciling what the Supreme Court itself acknowledged might have been two different possibilities based on prior precedents about what you do in a case where there might be prejudicial or even harmless error for something that an agency did during the regulatory process. So the Supreme Court decided to vacate and remand the decision. It will now go back to the Fifth Circuit. And there's a ton to talk about what this case means for administrative law and how agencies can change positions and what agencies are to do when they're not acting on a clean slate. So with that, I'm super excited to get into what our panelists have to say about it. And we're going to start with Professor Adler.
Good afternoon. It's great to be here. What I'm going to do relatively briefly is just try and set the stage for the decision so we understand the context in which this is occurring. And then I look forward to hearing from Professors Heckman and Pierce about their views of the doctrinal developments. So this case arises out of the FDA's regulation of vaping products, or what we sometimes call ENDS, electronic nicotine delivery systems. Basically, products that deliver mostly nicotine, although they can be used for other things as well, by heating a fluid and generating a vapor, and have been marketed as an alternative to combustible tobacco products, most notably cigarettes. The reason this area is an area of some controversy is, on the one hand, there's a fairly broad consensus, a position the FDA has accepted, that as best we can tell, these products pose substantially less risk to both users and bystanders than do combustible tobacco products, largely because you're not burning anything. And a very simple rule of thumb is that burning things and inhaling the smoke is bad for you. That can be coal, it can be tobacco, it doesn't matter what it is. Inhaling smoke is bad for your lungs, bad for your heart, and so on. Vaping products do not actually burn anything. They heat a fluid to generate a vapor. That typically, again, for the products we're talking about, deliver nicotine and a flavor of some sort. These products have been for about 18 years or so, and they are now subject to FDA regulation. So Congress in 2009 enacted a statute called the Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act, what some of us just call the Tobacco Act. This was a law that was a compromise between the nation's largest tobacco producer and tobacco control organizations to create a regulatory structure for the regulation of tobacco products, given that the Supreme Court had decided in a case called FDA versus Brown and Williamson that tobacco products could not be regulated under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. This law initially gave the FDA responsibility for regulating traditional tobacco products, cigarettes, loose tobacco, cigars, pipe tobacco, things like that, but gave the FDA authority as well to deem other products to be regulated tobacco products and subject them to the same regulatory structure. And in 2016, the FDA deemed ENDS, or vaping products, as tobacco products under the Act, and thereby subjected them to the broad overall regulatory structure. A key part of this regulatory structure is an approval process, kind of like we have for drugs and medical devices, for new tobacco products. So any tobacco product that was not on the market as of 2007, or is not the substantial equivalent of a product that was on the market in 2007, has to go through a pre-marketing approval process, again, much like that is applied to drugs and devices. As it happens, no commercially available or marketed vaping product it can be grandfathered in based on the regulatory standard. So unlike most cigarettes on the market, vaping products require FDA approval to be allowed to be marketed and sold legally. This declaration of deeming vaping products to be tobacco products, combined with the very narrow way the FDA decided to define what constitutes a discrete product, meant that there were literally millions of products that now had to be approval in the FDA. Unexpectedly to it, I was in a position of having to literally review somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 million or so product applications. The FDA initially wanted to do this relatively slowly and exercise its enforcement discretion to not take action against products that were already on the market and essentially prioritize what sorts of products it wanted to approve first or review first. But it was sued by some health groups and entered a settlement that required it to process all these applications by the year 2020, and in a time frame that made it impossible to provide the sort of individualized review that the statute anticipated. And I've certainly argued that having to do all of these product application reviews in such a short period is part of what led to the controversies that led to this case. Just also a fun footnote, the standing in the case that led to this settlement looks a lot like the standing argument that the Supreme Court would later unanimously reject in Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine versus FDA, but this case never went up. So the FDA is in the process of reviewing all these product applications and developed through this adjudicatory process, kind of some rules of thumb about what sorts of things it wanted to see in product applications and what things it deemed would not be acceptable or sufficient to approve a product. And this was something of a process that the FDA was developing as it was going along, as it was seeing and reviewing more product applications. It was both issuing guidance to manufacturers about what it wanted to see in its applications, but also in somewhat of an iterative process, revising things as it went along. And this case ended up being about the concern that the FDA changed its approach, that it gave guidance to manufacturers that certain sorts of information would be sufficient, and then ended up demanding more than that. Some things that are worth just noting is that the way the FDA decided to regulate here, and is part of what led to this particular case, but also some of the broader administrative law questions that I suspect some of our viewers are interested in, is that the FDA deliberately decided it was going to do this through adjudication rather than by adopting tobacco product standards that would actually define what is an acceptable vaping product and what isn't. And that's in the background of this litigation. In particular, the FDA thus far has refused to approve any product that has a non-cigarette flavor. Quick note, all vaping products are flavored. It's just that most of them are tobacco flavored, that most of what FDA has approved are tobacco flavored. That is not a natural flavor in vaping products, that is added. The FDA has approved mostly tobacco flavored products and a few menthol flavored products. Menthol is also flavoring that is legal in cigarettes. It has refused to approve any product with any other flavor. And in the background of this litigation is the concern that the FDA adopted a de facto rule against approving such flavors. But note that particular question was not presented to the court in this case. So while I and others are concerned the FDA is doing that, the Supreme Court was not asked to measure that. The other thing that's worth noting, and I'll conclude in a second, as I think many of our viewers understand, in a process in which an agency is making policy through adjudication and through individual approvals or denials of individual products, judicial review ends up focusing on the way the FDA evaluated the particular product application in a particular case. And the way the statute is written, that dynamic is reinforced because the standard the FDA is supposed to apply is whether marketing a particular product is, or the approval of marketing of a particular product is consistent with the protection of public health. So the FDA is looking at specific products. In this case, the products produced by a company called Wages and White Lion that are marketed under the brand name Triton. They are not looking at whether from a public health standpoint, a particular mix of products of various sorts and various flavors and whatever else would in fact be better for public health. In fact, by doing this product by product, the FDA has largely been able to avoid that question, the question it would have to confront if it, for example, were to issue a tobacco product standard that says we will not accept non-cigarette flavored vaping products. If the FDA went through notice and comment rulemaking on that, it would have to explain why it believes it is better for public health to not, say, have vanilla flavor or coffee flavor or berry flavor. It would have to confront the peer-reviewed empirical research suggesting that allowing such products on the market generally reduces youth smoking and makes it easier for at least some smokers to quit. But the FDA is not asked to think about that if it's looking at whether a particular product or a particular suite of products by a particular manufacturer is beneficial to public health, because it's very hard for, in particular, a small manufacturer to say, well, my product's the one that's going to adjust the market or provide for this broader public health benefit. Rather, FDA is saying, have you given us enough information about the benefits of your product? And the FDA has generally denied those. So in this case, it denied the approval of the products submitted by Wages and White Lion by Triton, concluding that for these products, they had not put forward enough information to demonstrate that approval of these products was consistent with the protection of public health. This was challenged in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit initially gave some injunctive relief to the manufacturer, then on the merits, sided with the FDA, and then in an en banc decision written by Judge Andy Oldham, concluded that the FDA had engaged in what was referred to as a surprise switcheroo. Basically, it had given guidance to manufacturers that a certain amount of information and certain types of studies and analysis and submissions would be acceptable, but had instead demanded more. The Fifth Circuit concluded that, the 11th Circuit had concluded that somewhat more narrowly in another case. Most other circuits to have heard similar claims, DC Circuit, Sixth Circuit, and so on, had rejected those claims. There was a circuit split, and the FDA sought certiorari. And as noted, the Supreme Court concluded unanimously that at least for three of the four things that Wages and White Lion claimed it did not have adequate notice of, or that it was misled on, that what the standard the FDA ultimately applied was sufficiently consistent with the guidance it had provided and the qualifications it had given in that guidance, and that for a fourth, it thought, the FDA conceded that it had changed its approach, and the Supreme Court is remanding that question back to the Fifth Circuit about the remedy, because there is a question about whether or not it actually made a difference in terms of the ultimate approval. So that's some background on the case, and I think at this point I am turning it over to Professor Heckman.
Thanks so much. So I want to highlight a couple of doctrinal moves that the Supreme Court made in Wages and White Lion that I think are potentially significant, at least. The first is the introduction of a novel two-step framework that the court labeled the change in position doctrine. And the second is how the court addressed the harmless error rule of the flush language at the end of APA Section 706. So starting with change of position doctrine. For decades, courts have required agencies to explain their thinking when they change policy. And unexplained agency flip-flopping has been considered arbitrary and capricious under the APA. The court talked about the demands of reasoned decision-making and State Farm-type arbitrary and capricious analysis when agencies change their minds in past decisions like FCC versus Fox Television Stations in 2009 and Encino Motor Cars versus Navarro in 2016, both of which concerned agencies changing their minds and replacing an older policy or interpretation of a statute with a different one. But the change in position label and the two-step framework announced in Wages and White Lion are new. In its decision in Wages and White Lion, the court addressed four separate claims that FDA had arbitrarily and capriciously changed its approach with respect to applications for market authorizations for vaping products. These changes concerned, first, the type of scientific evidence that was needed. Second, the need for manufacturers to compare their proposed products to other products. Third, enforcement priorities based on device type. And fourth, the inclusion of marketing plans as part of the application. To analyze these four claims, before getting to the claims themselves, the court described the two-step change in position framework that requires considering, first, whether the FDA changed course, and second, if it did, whether it offered satisfactory reasons for the change. Now, the court said that a change in course would include not only rescinding a prior regulation, but also abandoning a longstanding enforcement policy. And then the agency said the court said that if an agency has identifiably changed its position, then the second step of the new framework would require the agency to display awareness that it was changing position and to offer good reasons for the new policy, although the court suggested that the bar for justifying the change would not be a high one. So, quoting Fox Television, the court said that agency explanations for changed positions do not need to be more detailed or prove that a new position is better than the old one it replaced, but the court did suggest that an agency might need to address potential reliance on the old policy. So the court described the premise of this change in position doctrine as not allowing agencies to mislead regulated parties, saying that the essence of the respondent's argument is that the FDA told them in guidance documents that it would do one thing, and then it turned around and did something different when it reviewed their applications. Now, to my eye, part of what was interesting about this new two-step framework was how the court applied it to evaluate the FDA's actions in Wages and White Lion. So applying the first prong of the test narrowly, the court reviewed the cited FDA guidance and concluded regarding three of the four allegations that FDA's denial orders were sufficiently consistent with its pre-decisional guidance and thus did not run afoul of the change in position doctrine. In other words, whatever inconsistencies existed in the FDA's various actions leading to the denial orders, those inconsistencies did not rise to the level of a change in position. And as a result of that conclusion, the fact that FDA did not offer explanations for those changes was irrelevant. Its actions just were not arbitrary and capricious. So here is my concern. As framed by the court, the two-step framework for changes in position reminds me more than a little bit of the two-step Chevron test that the Supreme Court just overturned. The new two-step framework is more rigid and rule-like than the more open-ended State Farm analysis regarding changes when agencies change their mind that the two-step change in position doctrine replaces. Under Chevron, the lower courts got completely hung up on details for determining how clear was clear, how ambiguous was ambiguous, how clear was clear enough to avoid Chevron deference, or how ambiguous was sufficiently ambiguous to move to Chevron step two, including things like what tools of statutory interpretation to use in evaluating statutory clarity or ambiguity. And one reason that the Chevron standard became so unworkable was that the courts engaged in these never-ending debates over how Chevron's two steps operated. What I can envision, possibly, with this new two-step change in position framework is the lower courts getting hung up on how much change is enough of a change to be a change in position requiring explanation by an agency, and losing sight of the more important question of simply whether an agency's explanations of its actions represent reasoned decision-making. I'm also concerned that a finding that a change isn't enough of a change to require an explanation lets agencies off the hook altogether for explaining the trajectory of their choices as they go through a process like the one that they did here. A separate point I want to talk about is how the court approached harmless error analysis. So the FDA conceded regarding the fourth challenge that it changed its position by failing to consider the marketing plans that the FDA had advised regulated parties to include in their market authorization applications. And the FDA didn't really offer good reasons for failing to consider those marketing plans. The FDA didn't deny the change in position or the lack of explanation. They simply argued that the procedural error here was harmless. Now, the Supreme Court didn't resolve the question of the error's harmlessness, but the opinion did include an extensive discussion of harmless error review under the APA, including an extended discussion of the history of the doctrine and the tension between the APA's command that reviewing courts take due account of the rule of prejudicial error on the one hand, and the ordinary remand rule that courts usually follow when agency actions are inadequately explained. In Wages and White Lion, the Fifth Circuit had interpreted the Supreme Court's 2023 decision in Calcutt versus FDIC as limiting harmless error to cases in which the agency would be required, for example, by statute, to take the same action, irrespective of the reason provided by the agency for its action. And the Supreme Court in Wages and White Lion said that the Fifth Circuit had misinterpreted Calcutt. On the other hand, the court rejected FDA's argument based on a case called Shinseki versus Sanders from 2009 that the APA's harmless error rule should operate in the same manner as the rule of prejudicial error in civil cases. And the court here said that such a broad reading of harmless error would allow harmless error analysis to swallow the remand rule. Now, once upon a time, before Shinseki versus Sanders, the courts followed what I consider to be a somewhat more challenger-friendly standard derived from a 1967 D.C. Circuit decision called Braniff Airways that asked if remand to the agency to correct an error would be pointless because the error had no bearing on the procedure used or the substance of the decision reached. In other words, Shinseki versus Sanders seemed to move away from that challenger-friendly approach, as did Calcutt, although Calcutt's statement was extraordinarily brief, and the Fifth Circuit seemed to, you know, sort of take a single sentence and run with it. But in Wages and White Lion, the Supreme Court described harmless error analysis using the old challenger-friendly language from Braniff Airways. The court also said that remand may not be necessary when an agency's decision is supported by a plethora of factual findings, only one of which is unsound. But in discussing the Fifth Circuit's error regarding harmless error analysis in Wages and White Lion, the Supreme Court also declined to fully reconcile the remand rule and harmless error review. The court additionally declined to resolve whether FDA's failure to consider the marketing plans included in the rejected market authorization applications was harmless error, or to explain why it didn't FDA's consider the marketing plans represented harmless error. Instead, the court simply said, well, here's some guidance for the lower court. We don't like this approach. We don't like that approach. Go try again, and remanded the case to the Fifth Circuit to reconsider its own harmless error analysis under the proper standard. So those are two different doctrinal moves that I think have some potential applications in future cases that are really worth watching. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my co-author and friend, Professor Pierce, to talk about his view of the case.
Thanks, Kristen. So I'm going to do something quite uncharacteristic. I'm very comfortable criticizing Supreme Court opinions. I find very little to criticize in this opinion. There's actually a lot of characteristics that I find quite admirable. I just start with some basics. First, it's a decision on the merits docket instead of on the emergency docket, which means that it was based on full briefing, oral argument, reflection, research, and consideration of the views of a lot of lower court judges that expressed a wide range of views on the subject. I think the Supreme Court is as it is strongest when it's making decisions that way, and absolutely its weakest when it's making these hip shot decisions on the emergency docket. The second thing that I found reassuring and admirable is it was unanimous. My gosh, I'm desperately searching these days for any institutional context in which any government institution can engage in bipartisan decision making. And the fact that that is still possible, at least in some cases within our judicial system, I find reassuring. It's certainly not possible in either the executive or legislative branch. The executive branch does nothing but flip-flop back and forth, depending on who won the election. And the the legislative branch, nobody is willing to listen to anything that the other side has to say, and all that they can say about the other side are things that I dare not repeat in a public setting like this. Then third, it's one of a series of cases in which the Supreme Court takes seriously its ban on unexplained changes. And I think that's terribly important. That line of cases is terribly important in the extreme political polarity conditions that we have today, where the first thing that every newly elected president does is reverse most of the major decisions made by his predecessor. That creates a horrible, horrible legal environment. It has adverse effects in many ways. One of the ways in which it has horrible effects is on long-term investment decisions. You cannot make long-term investment decisions without having some notion that you can rely on some reasonably consistent legal environment for a sustained period of time. Well, we've discovered over the last 82 days that even in a single administration, you can get tremendous number of flip-flops that make it impossible to have a healthy environment for long-term investment. But at least the ban on unexplained changes position of agencies gives us some degree of assurance that there'll be some level of consistency, that the courts will not tolerate simply things like, I changed this because the president told me to. That things like explanations like that will not do, that they're going to have to come up with pretty particularized and persuasive explanations for changes in position. The way that the court approached it in this case, I'm less concerned than Kristen is about the details of it, because I think this was an unusual case where the changes in positions were all within a relatively brief time and quite frankly, it was just a reflection of tremendous confusion as the agency tried to cope with a seemingly impossible task of trying to decide whether to grant or deny 6.5 applications to market 6.5 million new products in a very brief period of time. And most of the change in position cases, you can identify the change in position quite easily. Encino is a good example. It's you go from yes to no. And that's clearly a change in position, and it's one that requires a pretty detailed, persuasive justification to support it. So I see this as just one in a line of cases that reinforce the importance of the ban on unexplained changes in position, and that's a doctrine that I think is particularly important. And then on the the harmless error issue. What I found encouraging there is I think all individuals, all government officials and all government institutions should be prepared to own their mistakes. And it is extraordinarily rare for any government official or any institution to own a mistake. The court owned a mistake here. The court said, okay, the Eighth Circuit had one approach. And the FDA had another approach, and it turns out we were the source of the problem. And then I think it also did the smart thing in saying, we may have some initial views on this, but we're going to turn this back over to the circuit court so we can at least start by getting their views on what the harmless error standard should be, and that will put us in a better position to make the ultimate decision about what the harmless error standard should be. But frankly, all of the, as I look pretty broadly at this opinion, I like a whole lot of things about it and have very little to say by way of criticism.
Excellent. Well, professors, thank you all so much. Before we get into the question and answer and Some audience questions are already rolling in that we'll get to. I want to mention briefly that as the professors were discussing the change in position doctrine, multiple times they mentioned that the FDA's initial position in part instances here were reflected in a non-binding guidance document. And I want to point sort of the careful observer who wonders, well, does the change in position doctrine apply when it's a non-binding guidance document to start, to footnote 5 of the court's opinion, where the court says, we assume for the purposes of this case that the change in position doctrine applies here. Usually it's when the agency is expressed in a more formal setting like FCC v. Fox Television. The court notes the DACA decision, DHS v. Regents, and says even there it would maybe have been a guidance document, but it was more of a standardized review process. In any event, potentially a question for a future case, maybe a future courthouse steps decision. So let's get into some questions here. And I want to start with Professor Adler. So Professor, you mentioned that when reading the opinion, it's clear, it seems that some in the regulated community felt a little bit misled by the FDA's regulatory approach here. Could you give us maybe a little bit more background of what exactly it was that might have gone on here? You know, why was it the case that the FDA carried out the process this way? And, you know, even if it didn't change its position in a way that was arbitrary and capricious, why it led to maybe some surprise in the regulatory community?
I mean, two things. One, I mean, some of it was necessity. I mean, as Professor Pierce noted, they had 6.5 million product applications to review. Now, that's a consequence of the FDA's own choices. That is to say, the FDA chose to deem vaping products to be tobacco products, even though they don't contain tobacco, to subject them to this regulatory regime. The FDA chose to define what constitutes a product so narrowly that what most people would consider to be a single product can actually often require multiple applications because different amounts of nicotine, different flavorings, different product sizes end up being a different size. So the comparator is if you sold cigarettes and sold them in two different box sizes, so the exact same cigarettes, but different numbers of cigarettes, that's two separate products, two separate applications. So the FDA decided that we're going to subdivide this so much. The FDA decided to do this deeming. And then the FDA decided to settle this case and agree to a ridiculous timeframe for these approvals rather than fighting on standing to challenge what I think was an absolutely ridiculous district court opinion that set these deadlines. As again, When the same standing theory ultimately reached the Supreme Court in the AHM case, the Supreme Court unanimously rejected it. But the Supreme Court the FDA didn't fight that battle in the context of vaping. So the FDA put itself in a box where it had to do all these products very, very quickly. The FDA Tobacco Office is a relatively new office that doesn't have the set of procedures and practices and kind of institutional culture as the other divisions of FDA did. So it didn't have that kind of institutional structure and set of norms to rely upon that other agencies might. There is evidence, there was the Reagan-Udall report on this, of dysfunction within FDA's Tobacco Office, some conflict about how it should approach questions of harm reduction. So that's some of it in the background. Then specifically, the FDA initially saying, okay, these are the sorts of things we want. And FDA, I think, initially was trying to be open to the idea that this is an area where there's been a lot of product evolution, there's been a lot of innovation, a lot of competition along variables that traditionally we haven't seen with traditional tobacco products, right? Traditional tobacco products have been a fairly cartelized industry for some time. The vaping product industry up until now was not, although a consequence of this regulatory process is going to be to cartelize it the way the industry is for traditional tobacco products. And I think the FDA was kind of open to the idea that those in the space may have a sense of how best to present the information about their products and what they're learning about their products and how they compare to other products, how their risks may differ, how adding these products may relate to public health. But that over time, the FDA realized, you know, a lot of what we're getting isn't doesn't give us confidence. And so we are going to still treat things like more traditional medical studies to be the gold standard. But so a lot of companies thought that they could, that they didn't have to engage in the more long-term detailed sorts of studies that you would expect, say, with drug approval or device approval. I'll note one other dynamic is, and you see this in which products are approved, right? For big companies, traditional tobacco companies that either created or acquired vaping products and have significant research departments and lots of money to spend developing the sort of product applications that the FDA wanted to see, is much easier than for a relatively small, say, regional vaping fluid manufacturer that is trying to provide for a wide range of fluids in terms of nicotine strength and flavoring in response to consumer demands. And it's just harder to come up with comprehensive information about the effects of a product if you're talking about a smaller niche product and it's coming from a smaller company that doesn't have those resources. And so the FDA gravitated towards wanting to approve the sorts of product applications it was going to get from, say, an RJ Reynolds or an Enjoy or a Logic, one of the bigger companies, while rejecting those from a lot of these smaller, more regional companies. And I think those smaller regional companies felt that was a bit unfair because they were initially told that while those bigger product applications would be desirable, that they weren't absolutely essential. And so they felt that they were subject to a switcheroo. I will note, and last point on this, and this came out in oral argument, the language of the statute, in addition to the guidances that FDA put out, certainly gave applicants an awareness that the more traditional type of application, the application that looked more like a drug application, was a bit of a safe harbor. And I think that a lot of manufacturers felt that since the FDA never said you absolutely have to have an application that looks like that, they expected more favorable assessments of less traditional sorts of applications. And the FDA ultimately didn't want to approve those. There's a separate issue about flavoring versus, you know, cigarette flavor versus non-cigarette flavor. But again, as the way I look at the briefing and I look at the Supreme Court's decision, that really isn't what the court focused on. There's a separate question there about whether non-cigarette flavored products were treated to a different standard that the FDA should have adopted through rulemaking. But again, I don't think that was squarely presented to the court. I don't think that was decided here.
Excellent. We have a treat. We have an audience question from a leading FDA scholar, Professor Erica Lietzan from Missouri Law, and it's for Professor Hickman. So Professor Lietzan asks, on your first point, would you not consider the experience of agencies and courts with the logical outgrowth doctrine, maybe to provide some basis for making these decisions, maybe something like a framework that we could pull from there? Are there theoretical reasons to think the analysis might be quite similar to that doctrine?
Well, so, I mean, at least on a surface level, you know, so the logical outgrowth test for ascertaining whether a notice used in a notice of proposed rulemaking is adequate, you know, does the agency change its approach too much between the notice of proposed rulemaking and the final rules such that we can't say that the final rule is a logical outgrowth of the notice of proposed rulemaking? You know, certainly, at least on a certain superficial level, you're talking about the same kind of inquiry. You're talking about change, right? But the goals of the two requirements, I think, are somewhat different with, you know, I mean, here in the context of at least potentially different. So here in the context of this particular case, the switcheroo is you provided us with guidance and then made your decision based on other grounds. That kind of looks logical outgrowth-ish in a certain way. And yet when you look at other changes in position, when agencies are, they've adopted one policy on day one, and then they adopt a different policy at a different time, that kind of a flip-flop, you know, really isn't about necessarily notice at all. It's about pretext, you know, or it's about, you know, does the agency have good reasons for why it changed its policy? I think that's one of the reasons why I'm a little bit uncomfortable with this two-part test is, you know, previously when we talked about agency changes in position and we talked about reasoned decision making under State Farm type analysis, you know, I always teach that doctrine as being, you know, very case by case or rulemaking by rulemaking specific, that it really can vary depending upon, you know, the explanation that's required and the analysis that the court engages in can vary considerably depending on the facts and circumstances of the agency action in question. Boiling that into a two-part test like the court has done here, I fear anyway that we're going to do things such as say, oh, pull from the logical outgrowth strand of jurisprudence, or we're going to try to make what the inquiry is more uniform than it has been in the past. And I think it's more uniform than I think it's capable of being if we're to truly capture the spirit of State Farm style reasoned decision-making analysis.
Professor Pierce, the next question is for you. And it's from an attendee who wonders whether the court obtained a unanimity in this case by maybe sacrificing a more detailed explanation of the interplay between, for example, Chenery and the prejudicial error rule. Do you have any concern that the court may have sacrificed more detailed explanation for unanimity? And is that maybe a counterweight to your praising of the court's unanimous decision in this case?
Well, I have no way of knowing whether or to what extent that actually took place. I think it is entirely plausible. I am certainly aware that it is a phenomenon that takes place on a pretty regular basis at the Supreme Court. I think it's just the price of having a nine-justice court. Trying to come up with language that will be clear and explicit and satisfy nine justices is a challenge. And frankly, it's often a challenge to come up with language that is clear that five justices can agree to. So I don't have any doubt that happens to some extent. And whether the sacrifice is worth it is, I think, necessarily a case-by-case determination, and I don't have anything like the kind of detailed understanding of what happens in any particular case be critical or to say, well, gosh, there was too much sacrifice of detail in the process of compromise in this case. There are certainly cases where, well, Loperbright is a recent example. I sure would have liked if they had said, here is the new standard. Okay. And my guess, it's only a guess, but I'm pretty confident that the reason they didn't do that is there are not five justices that agree on what any new standard is. And if there aren't five justices that agree, well, you're not going to get a standard. I'm reminded of back in that the period between 1984 and 2000, when we were all complaining that the court had not made clear the scope of Chevron. And then the court, in a period of 18 months, issues three opinions that make it quite clear to all of us that the reason they haven't done that is they don't know what the hell they're doing, and they are in tremendous disagreement. And so getting clear, detailed instructions in a 3-3-3 lineup of justices is, to me, not very helpful. And so the extent to which they engaged in a little bit of sacrifice of detail to obtain unanimity in this case is, I think, just fine with me.
If I could just jump in there and add to that, I mean, I think it's important to recognize how narrowly the case ultimately was presented to the court. And you know, was there some of us that may suspect that there are some justices that have a lot of sympathy for Justice Jackson's dissent in Chenery 2 and that are uncomfortable with the due process and other implications of allowing agencies to engage in the sort of policymaking through adjudication that, you know, is the hallmark of Bell Aerospace and Wyman Gordon and so on, and these other cases that the admin law junkies will be familiar with. But that really wasn't put before the court in a way that it had to think about or address that. And so if it's operating within the framework that Chenery 2, as interpreted in these subsequent cases, is perfectly fine, then there is an extent to which it's much easier to get the sort of agreement that Professor Pierce is talking about, because however much some of the justices might think this edifice is problematic, they're not being asked to unpack it. And they certainly weren't given the briefing that they would need to try and unpack it. They were instead say, okay, given these assumptions, let's look at an agency doing what lots of agencies do, which is develop policy over time through lots of adjudications. And that involves inevitably some amount of an iterative process where they are on the margin changing things a little bit as they get new information, as they accumulate more experience, and that being too rigid about an agency's ability to do that is in effect challenging the edifice. But if challenging the edifice is not part of the case, then it's much easier to say, okay, if we assume this is what we're going to do, it's got to be able to work along these lines. And I think that's part of why the court was able to get that unanimity here.
Excellent. I want to loop Professor Hickman into the discussion here, because we're talking about Chenery, but the change in position doctrine, it seems maybe to be best understood as one component part of arbitrariness review, or should we understand the court's decision to be thinking about arbitrariness review as maybe overshadowed by the change in position question? Because at least it seems to me, it's something of a bit of a hollow inquiry. It's, do you acknowledge that you're changing a position? Do you have good reasons for the change? But then arbitrariness review often will also ask, well, what about that underlying policy? What do we think about whether it was arbitrary? Thoughts on what the future of arbitrariness review in these kinds of situations is going to look like?
Well, so, I mean, again, State Farm does a lot of different things. And is highly variable depending on the facts and circumstances of the particular agency action in question. Contemplating how agencies are supposed to explain their actions when they are changing positions has been a subject of a strand of arbitrary and capricious cases. I think particularly including Fox Television is where they talked about it the most. So I don't want to go so far as to say that change in position doctrine is just going to completely swamp arbitrary and capricious review and replace it altogether. Even in circumstances where you're talking about changes, I think what I'm talking about is at least in the subset of those cases where the crux of the complaint is that the agency has changed its position, that by putting the existing guidance from the Supreme Court into this two-step framework, I really think we have potentially, it's hard to say just on the basis of one Supreme Court decision, but I think there's the potential for that two-step test, yes, to replace sort of the portion of State Farm analysis that deals with agency changes such that we get fixated. You know, Dick made the point about how, you know, agency flip-flopping 180 degrees. You know, the answer was yes, and now the answer is no. When you look at the way the court applied step one of this two-step framework fairly narrowly to say, well, we don't have that kind of 180-degree flip-flop with the changes here, thus we don't have a change in position, thus there's no explanation required, really narrows the explanation that the agency is required to provide such that I think if you know, I fear that courts will get hung up on this question of how much of a change is too much of a change or is enough of a change to require an explanation, and that the overall explanatory expectations as agencies maybe change, but in lesser ways, that I think you might have seen under prior State Farm analysis will get replaced altogether.
Professor Pierce, can I follow up then with you? The court's decision seems to suggest a narrower reading of State Farm going forward. Is that right? Do you think that the court will move away from or interpret more narrowly State Farm in future arbitrariness review cases where there's a change in position question?
I hope not, because I'm a fan of the State Farm approach, and I at least would like to believe that it is still the situation that Kristen originally described, where the ban on unexplained changes is part of the arbitrary and capricious analysis, or the duty to engage in reasoned decision making. I do think. And you can see it to some extent in this opinion, even that in one or two spots, they say, well, even if there was, this was a change, arguendo in position, the court explained it sufficiently. So I do see at least some aspects of the broader duty to engage in reasoned decision making, which I think is what State Farm and arbitrary and capricious review is all about and should be all about.
Professor Adler, we'll close out with a question to you, and I'm going to take moderator's privilege here to combine a few audience questions, given how closely you've been following the litigation. One questioner asks, what do you anticipate the lower court will do now? I mean, there's not a lot left to be done. And then another questioner asks, do we think there's a possibility that we'll see a wages two in the future of the Supreme Court? I wonder if you could take those together.
Yeah, so I'm going to three quick points. First, in terms of what Professors Hickman and Pierce were just talking about, it's worth remembering the only question before the court was whether the denials were arbitrary and capricious. So while there were overtones in the briefing and in the Fifth Circuit about due process, lack of notice, other sorts of arguments that we think of in a change of circumstance or change of position context, that was not the question the court accepted certiorari on. There was no cross petition for certiorari by the respondent seeking to broaden the range of what the court should consider. And the Fifth Circuit opinion was sprawling enough that, you know, maybe that could have been done, but it wasn't. In terms of what happens on remand, you know, my concern is that the court really only expects the Fifth Circuit to look at one little thing, which is the effect of the change in position on marketing plans. And it's going to be difficult to get that declared arbitrary and capricious if that's the only thing on the table. So I'm concerned that the Fifth Circuit really has a narrow set of things it's allowed to look on. In terms of whether we see a wages two, I've had a concern that I've been voicing for years now, that the FDA has been very strategic in this process, in avoiding litigation with larger companies who are hiring folks that are really sophisticated administrative law folks, and instead letting all the cases go to the circuit courts that are smaller companies that don't have the finances, that don't have the resources, that have, you know, by necessity, thinner applications, so that they can rack up the wins in circuit after circuit, so that they basically have the ability to run the approval process the way they want. And I fear that we're getting very close to that point, right? The FDA has avoided going toe-to-toe in court against Juul, against Turning Point, against Logic, against Reynolds. You know, they've largely avoided that. And I think that's deliberate. And I think the aim is to kind of close off the avenues of challenges to the broader questions, like, is it arbitrary and capricious for the FDA to, even in the document it attaches to these product denials, not mention any of the peer-reviewed research suggesting that when you take flavored products off the market, more kids smoke, right? Maybe that justifies maybe you can still justify not approving non-cigarette flavored products. Maybe you can't. It's a concern that an agency that has a health regulation responsibility can say we are going to effectively not approve any of these products and never even have to address the research that's been published in JAMA, that's been published in Journal of Health Economics. You know, serious work by people at places like Yale saying that there are very serious interplays about in nicotine and tobacco consumption based on what sorts of things are on the market. I would love to see that eventually get to the Supreme Court. I think the FDA has been a very sophisticated litigant in the way it's approached this, and it's closing off the opportunities to get a clear litigation on some of those sorts of questions.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for really a terrific discussion today to this wonderful panel, and I will hand it over to Kayla to close us out.
I will echo those thanks. I really appreciate you as our panel joining and sharing your expertise and insights for breaking down this case. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. Welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.